Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome everybody. Today, Pacific Northwest Island writer and number one New York Times bestselling author Susan Wiggs ends our show with her latest book, The Beekeeper's Ball, and this one is touted by certain critics as her best ever. We'll also hear a little from Adam Grant, Wharton's youngest professor and highest-rated teacher, on Give and Take, and we'll hear a few words from Tel Ben-Shahar, who taught the most popular Harvard class in the entire history of Harvard. But to begin today's show, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Susan Carnell. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Carnell's research focuses on the psychological and biological drivers of appetite. And, you know, if you've ever heard the phrase thinking with your stomach, you might want to rethink that. Dr. Carnell is going to tell us why. Dr. Carnell, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Oh, a fellow Brit. I didn't know that.
I was just working that out myself. There's a few of us expats over here.
Yeah, I had somebody joining me next week is also from Britain. We do get around. So you're a very exciting subject, this, because I watched some of the outtakes from National Geographic Channel's, it's an Emmy-nominated series called Brain Games. And, you know, I have to say Brain Games didn't entice me in until I started watching it. And it's fascinating. How did you get involved with this?
It is a really great show. So actually, the producers found me because I actually have a kind of passion for communicating about science. So I kind of had a blog and I've done a few talks which made it onto YouTube. And I think they knew they were doing an episode about food and they could see that I was as passionate as they are about communicating science in a fun way. So that's how they reached out to me, I think.
Right. And how did you get involved? I mean, what kind of track did your career go on to follow this aspect of what drives us? How did you become interested in that?
Sure. Well, I think really I'm just very interested in how people differ. I'm a psychologist and that's kind of what we're interested in. And what actually got me interested in was thinking about the obesity epidemic and how this is really kind of driven by all these factors that have changed in the world, like the sort of wide availability of high-calorie foods. Yet what interests me is why some people are affected and some people aren't. So that's actually led me to look at maybe family influences and genetic influences and environmental influences, which might be affecting how our brains respond to food, which might actually make some of us more at risk of obesity than others. So that's actually my research focus.
It is fascinating, and I love the way that National Geographic, it makes this program such fun. I was kind of watching it with one eye, and all of a sudden I'm forgetting everything else around me, and I'm totally drawn into this topic.
Yeah, it really is compelling, and I think it's because it's about curiosity, you know. So it's those shows are often presenting surprising findings, and as a scientist, that's actually the kind of the most fun for us too. When we do a study, we don't always expect to get the answers that we do. And I think this Brain Games episode is going to present people with lots of kind of surprising findings about people's automatic responses to food.
Yes, and we should say that this episode that you're featured in is actually on tonight on National Geographic channel, Brain Games. And it's on, I believe, at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on the National Geographic channel. So So tell us a little bit then about, you know, we often think that it's our taste buds. You know, I can think of my mouth watering when I look at certain things, and we think it's our mouth that's telling us we want this food, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
That's right. Actually, kind of everything's working together. So actually our whole bodies and our whole brains are geared to find food in the environment, and that's how we survive. So the taste buds are certainly part of it, and hormones which are kind of released in response to food. But also our brains can respond even just to the sight of a piece of food or a food picture. Or we've done some work showing that reward areas in the brain are activated even just by hearing the sound of food or even a food word spoken. So if you actually listen to the word chocolate brownie, and you think about those, that could actually get you salivating and get your reward areas activated too.
Yes, and those of us who have dogs know that works very well with dogs.
Right.
They only have to hear the rustling of a packet and then the drool will start.
That's right, and I think what's surprising is that humans too, you know.
Yes. So let's look a little at appetite and cravings for certain types of food. One of the things that fascinated me was that newborn babies, they found, can discern flavours and tastes right from the get-go.
That's right. It's really very striking. I was actually at a conference just in Seattle recently called the Society of the Study of Ingestive Behavior, and someone showed these pictures of infants responding to sweet taste and actually rats responding to sweet taste. And they make pretty much the same movements with their mouth. So there's a kind of licking response, and the same with bitter. So it's actually a feature which is kind of common to all species, and we're really born having those preferences for sugar foods, sugary sweet foods, and kind of being averse to bitter foods.
Right. So I got, no doubt about it, addicted to sweet foods. And I've been off them for a few months. And I had one of my, the things that I used to have every day, picked it up from a coffee shop, and I used to have it almost every day because it was, you know, low fat, supposedly low calorie. I couldn't finish it. It was so sweet. And yet when I was eating it every day, I couldn't get enough of it. So tell us what really is going on in the brain and why we get so addicted and why it's so hard to give that up.
That's very interesting. So, and this was actually a kind of diet food that you were eating regularly, or was it a kind of...
It was actually a little low-fat berry coffee cake.
Mm. Well, so I guess there's two interesting things there. So one is that the kind of low-fat revolution made people take a lot of fat out of foods, but then to make it for the taste, they put a lot of sweetness in. So that's why some of those products started getting so sweet. And then I think you're also making another really interesting point, which is how your tastes change over time with exposure to different foods.
Right.
So actually, if you kind of keep eating, for example, very sugary, very fat foods, then it might be that your brain actually kind of stops responding as much to them. So you actually feel the need to eat even more of them to get the same response. So there are these strange kind of learning things that happen over time. And that how that happens is actually a really hot topic in eating behavior research. We're still trying to understand how that happens.
Yeah. One of the things I found fascinating on the website was it said that gaining weight can actually affect our sense of taste, which makes sense to me because, like I said, I just was craving all this sweet stuff all the time.
Yeah, it's very interesting. These kind of vicious cycles can get started. But as you said, then if you kind of have a period where you actually change your diet, you may be able to kind of reset yourself.
Right.
So
right.
There's always potential to kind of change your habits and preferences.
Yeah. So we all know, I think intellectually, we know that products are marketed towards us to get us to buy, whether they're good for us or not. But what are some of the things that we should be aware of that maybe we're not aware of when we go shopping about packaging and how it's enticing us?
Right. Well, I think, I mean, basically the industry is kind of using everything it can to entice us to buy something. And this includes kind of prices and pictures and things like that. For example, in children's foods, often kind of cartoon characters are used and things which children enjoy. And these kind of good things become associated with the food and make us want to buy them. So I suppose it's just really to be aware that all of that's happening. And it's a very powerful influence on the brain. So it can overcome our kind of natural hunger signals. So I guess it's just something to be aware of when you go into a supermarket, to kind of ask yourself, am I really hungry or am I just being kind of bombarded? Is my brain just being bombarded by these images and making me think I want something when I don't really need it?
Right. So if we're trying to change our eating patterns, what would you say is one of the top tips for staying aware of this propensity to, you know, challenge us to eat stuff we don't want to eat?
Right. Well, there's kind of a number of things. I mean, one movement which is quite popular in the field at the moment is mindful eating. So this is the idea that you should kind of encourage yourself to really concentrate on your food when you're eating it. So instead of the opposite would be mindless eating, when you're sitting in front of the television and you're just kind of chowing down and not really thinking. Mindful eating might suggest you turn off the television and you have no distractions, and you sit down and you really focus on how each bite tastes. That probably means you might end up eating slowly, more slowly, which actually is also good for fullness sensations, because when you eat something, it kind of travels down your stomach and into your gut, and then hormones are released which actually tell your brain that you're full. So if you eat more slowly, there's more chance for that to happen, and that can help. So I guess kind of a mindful, slower eating approach is something that has helped people.
Right. I think there's also another good reason for turning off the television, because when you are trying to eat more healthfully, you become aware of all the food commercials on there in between programs.
That's right. And it's really quite shocking how many. So some people in the field are kind of looking at the number of food commercials, and it really is quite striking. That's one of the kind of main topics which are advertised. And there's obviously a lot of advertising to children, which sometimes is a little worrying, because they're not as able to discriminate between a useful message and a not so useful message.
Right. Good point. So I'm talking with Dr. Suzanne Connell here, and she's featured in National Geographic Channel's Brain Games, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock Pacific and Eastern on the National Geographic Channel. What can we expect to see on there, Dr. Connell?
You can expect to see a lot of fun experiments, probably some interesting factoids and perceptual illusions that you weren't aware that you were kind of falling prey to. There's a lot of kind of man on the street demonstrations, so you'll see kind of how people respond to different foods and different manipulations that the presenters give. And I think probably people will learn a little bit more about kind of what's going on under the hood when they're just kind of eating in real life, and how the biology is kind of influencing it, and how environmental factors are kind of driving them to eat.
Yeah, they have a couple of fun little games on the National Geographic website, the Brain Games website. And one of them, I underestimated this when I took it, but the question was, what percentage of overeating is emotionally motivated? And I thought probably about 60, 65%, and it was actually 75%. That's really high.
Yes, it's interesting because, the world has changed so much. It used to be there wasn't a lot of food around. So really, most of our feeding was driven by genuine hunger. We really kind of needed it to stay alive. But now, actually, a lot of us are getting enough food to do that, but we're still surrounded by all these images. So actually now, even more so, our kind of hunger, in quotation marks, is motivated by the environment and less by these internal signals.
Yeah. So one other thing that I thought was interesting I wanted to share with our listeners was which is the fattiest part of the body, and that, of course, was the brain. Tell us about that a little, if you would.
Right, yeah, I think that's kind of an interesting point to make, because especially when you look at things in context, so in the 70s and the 80s, there was a bit of a backlash against fat, and everyone kind of demonized fat. But actually, of course, our body needs fat. It doesn't perhaps necessarily need so much saturated fat. It doesn't need kind of French fries in the same way it might need other fats. But the fats you find in things like avocados and nuts are actually very, very good for you. And indeed, the body kind of runs on fat. Fat's a very important organ. It's not something that just kind of, sticks around on our thighs that we don't want.
Right.
It is doing something.
Right.
It's just, in the modern world, it can get a little out of hand.
Yeah. So tell us what you'd like listeners to take away from tonight's show. If they hear nothing else.
I think it's really just the fact that a lot of our eating is actually automatic. So we see these cues and we're triggered to eat, and we think some things will be good and some things won't. And people can actually become quite limited in their kind of behavioral repertoire when it comes to food. And I hope this show just makes them kind of think a little bit more about why they're behaving a certain way, and perhaps encourage them to try eating a different way.
Yeah.
Or perhaps eating more healthily if they're not inclined to do that already.
Right. Well, it's definitely a fun show and packed full of really great information. And again, it airs tonight on National Geographic Channel. It's called Brain Games. And my guest, Dr. Suzanne Connell, will be featured in that show. And it's all about food tonight, right?
That's right. Yes, my favorite topic.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
And please do stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Let's see if I guess that... this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing. Writing it, another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with a write coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, alternative talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. I love how Eric has fun with the music. Tell us that what that was, because we just talked about Sugar and the Brain.
That was the band Sugar doing the song If I Can't Change Your Mind.
So. Right. Talking about mindful eating.
There you go.
Well, thank you, Eric. And as promised, I brought you today. We're going to listen to a couple of my favorite guests from male guests, because we looked at some strong women last week. So we're going to play a couple of clips from shows with some of my favorite male guests from last year. And so I wanted to follow on with around the topic of the brain, since we kicked off with that, with National Geographic's Brain Games. And I loved this book. It was called Give and Take, and you can find out more about this book at giveandtake.com, giveandtake.com. And let me just read you Robert Sutton. He was he's an author, and he said this about the book Give and Take. It might just be the most important book of this young century. As insightful and entertaining as Malcolm Gladwell at his best, this book has profound implications for how we manage our careers, deal with our friends and relatives, raise our children, and design our institutions. The gem is a joy to read, and it shatters the myth that greed is the path to success. I couldn't have put that better myself, so I wanted to share his review of Adam Grant's book with you. Adam Grant was the youngest full professor and single highest rated teacher at Wharton. He's been recognized as one of Business Week's favorite professors, one of the world's best business professors under 40, and one of Malcolm Gladwell's favorite social science writers. He speaks all over the world, and I mean that literally, at Google, the NFL, Merck, Pixar, you name it, he's been there. He's very much in demand. He's designed experiential learning activities at Wharton based on the Apprentice show, in which students have raised almost $500,000 for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. He's just out there. He's young. He's having fun. He's being influential. And his book was called Give and Take. Let me tell you about the little clip we're going to play here. When I was younger, my aunt used to say to me, honey, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are givers and there are takers. When you figured out which one you're dealing with, you're ahead of the game. And Adam Grant, after extensive research, talking with thousands of people, he's come up with three kinds of people. And we're going to talk about that right now. Adam Grant.
Overall, givers are people who enjoy helping others and will often do it without any strings attached. You know, you can think about sharing knowledge or making introductions or being a mentor, or giving advice, solving problems. And, you know, you can think about really two different ways of doing that. One is a very selfless approach, which is, you know, putting other people first all the time and exhausting your time and energy and resources. And the other is what I call an otherish approach. That might be a word that never should have been invented. When I think about being otherish, it means, you know, putting other people first a lot of the time, but also being thoughtful about your own goals and ambitions and making sure that your helping and giving doesn't sacrifice those.
Right. And so then takers obviously are those who don't do any of those.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about takers, I think about them as the people who are always trying to get as much as possible from others and don't want to give anything back. You know, they're good at really critical skills like social loafing, you know, the shirking, the free riding, you know, making sure other people do all the boring, unpleasant work and yet somehow coming out hogging all the credit.
Yeah, I know a few of those. They're often the people who go, oh, well, I'm the ideas person. You guys are the ones here to do the work.
That sounds like a classic taker.
I think sometimes takers can be hard to recognize at first if they're experienced at this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of takers are good fakers. And, you know, what I find, as you know from the book, is there's a common pattern of kissing up, kicking down, where when takers are dealing with powerful people, they want to make a really good impression, and so they create this aura of generosity. But if you're a taker, it is a lot of work to pretend to be helpful with all the people you meet. And so you're going to let your guard down a little bit more when you're dealing with your peers and subordinates who, you know, who you think are less influential in your life, and that's often, you know, where you get to see true colors.
Right. You do say at some point in the book that, yes, takers can change, and givers who, you know, maybe give too much can change. But do you think this is intrinsic to who we are, basically?
Well, I think like all questions in psychology, it's a combination of nature and nurture. The evidence suggests that when you look at giving behaviors like charitable donations, for example, that about 30% of the variance in charitable giving is genetically explained, which leaves a lot left over for, you know, our life experiences and our choices. And, you know, I think that choice point is really important because these are decisions we make in every interaction we have with another person. So, you know, think about the biggest taker you know, and unless that person is a psychopath or a sociopath, there are probably moments where that person, you know, instead of just trying to get something, offers a trade that's fair and balanced, which is what a matcher would do, and we can talk more about that, Or, you know, even some roles or relationships where that person might operate a little more like a giver and say, you know what, I'm going to try to offer something and, you know, I'm not really going to expect anything in return. And, you know, I think that as people shift that mindset, they can change their styles over time.
Right. Now, what you just mentioned matches, and I wanted to ask you, what is how do we differentiate between a matcher and a taker? Because as you said, they can be difficult to, I think, tell apart at first.
That's right. So, you know, a matcher at the core is somebody who tries to maintain an even balance of give and take. You know, think of people who just live their lives by the norm of reciprocity,
right,
where everything is quid pro quo. You know, if you do me a favor, then I feel like I'm in debt until I paid it back. And, you know, when I help you out, I want an equal favor in return. And what you will find with matchers is they spend a lot of time sort of keeping track, right, of debits and credits. They always want to keep a zero balance sheet. And you could actually, Gretchen Rubin called them the karma police, which I thought was a great term. You know, matchers believe that what goes around comes around, and they really want to see the world as a just and fair place. And so, you know, that means that when somebody's a taker, matchers like to punish that person. And, you know, when somebody's a giver, matchers feel like, well, you know, that should be really rewarded.
Mm.
And so, you know, you won't see takers necessarily going out of their way to sort of restore the scales of justice, whereas, you know, that's often a mission that you will see matchers launch into.
And that was a clip from a show we did with Adam Grant. You can find more about Adam Grant and his work at giveandtake.com. That book really is a fascinating read. And I challenge anybody to read it all the way through and look at people they don't know, or even some they do know, in the same way. Really interesting. So continuing along the brain theme, wanted to bring you a clip from Tal Ben-Shahar. This is just a short little clip. He wrote a New York Times bestseller called Happier. He was the teacher of the most popular course in Harvard history, and he's a positive psychology expert. In fact, his whole website is like a virtual positive psychology toolbox for anybody who's interested in taking a look. When I talked with him, he just released a new book called Choose the Life You Want, 101 Ways to Create Your Own Road to Happiness. And as I said, he's a Harvard professor, he's an author, he's a lecturer, he teaches literally all over the world. When we talked with him, he was actually in Israel. And this interview that I'm going to bring with you, this particular clip, is focused on the second book, the Choose the Life You Want. 101 Ways to Create Your Own Road to Happiness. And he literally, Ben Tal, literally traveled all over the world meeting with thousands of people to research this book, and decided that he had a new life-changing lesson to share, draw on the latest psychological research and these thousands of interviews that he did. So this particular class that he taught at Harvard, and I said was the most it's the number one most popular class at Harvard in history. 20% of the entire student population attended it. And it was focused around two questions. Number one, why aren't I happy? Number two, how can I be happier? So let's play a clip from that interview right now. And it begins with me asking Tal Ben-Shahar a question. I love that you say there are two kinds of people who do not experience painful emotions, psychopaths and the dead.
Right. And let me tell you, when I first thought about this, it was actually during the first year when I taught a class on happiness, and I was a resident tutor in one of the undergraduate dorms, and one of the students comes over to me and says, you know, Tal, I hear you're teaching a class on happiness. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, my roommates are taking your class. And I said, that's great. And then he said to me, but, you know, now that you're teaching a class on happiness, you've got to watch out. And I said, what? And he said, you've got to be careful. And I said, why? And he said, because if I see you unhappy, I'll tell them. I'll tell my roommates. And, you know, I actually used that the next day in class, and I told the students, you know, that the last thing I want them to think is that I experienced a constant high, or that anyone for that matter experiences, except for the psychopaths and the dead. You know, they maybe don't experience painful emotions.
Yeah.
But we all do, you know, it's part of life.
Yes, and one thing that I've heard as a recurring theme when I've talked with psychologists over the years is that resilience to those painful emotions, to those painful circumstances, those heartbreaking events, the loss of a loved one, loss of a job. The resilience is a key component. Would you agree with that?
Exactly. It's the key component because we all experience them. The only difference between, you know, people who are unhappy, even depressed, and people who are happy is how we handle these emotions. That they're there is inevitable. It's as inevitable as the law of nature. The question is, what do we do when we face these emotions? Are we able to bounce back or not? And here's the interesting paradox. It's actually when we accept these emotions as part and parcel of life, of any life, and certainly our life, it's when we accept them and experience them, that's when we're more likely to overcome them. In other words, that's when we are more likely to be resilient, to bounce back.
Right, right. So I want to talk, let's jump into the book a little here. You tell a story in the beginning of the book, which made me laugh. A guy sits down with his co-workers at lunch every single day, and every single day he complains, oh no, not peanut and jelly sandwiches again, I hate them. And eventually one of his co-workers said, for goodness sake, if you hate them so much, tell your old lady to make something different. Would you finish that story for us?
Sure, sure. Well, this is a story taken from a wonderful book by Dan Millman, The Path of the Peaceful Warrior. And it's about this guy who, you know, complains about his peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and his co-worker said, come on, so tell your old lady to make a different sandwich. And he said, what are you talking about? I'm not married. I make my own sandwiches. And Dan Millman, and then I extended in my book, uses it as a metaphor for the way we construct, day in and day out, construct our own lives. And very often, metaphorically speaking, make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, even though we don't like them and we don't realize, we're not conscious of the fact that we're the ones creating the kind of life that we're living. And just as we're creating peanut butter, you know, and jelly sandwiches that we may not like, we can also create sandwiches that we do like. It is up to us. And the basic premise of my book is that at every moment in our life, we have a choice.
We do indeed. We have a choice. And sometimes because we're human, remembering that is the problem. But as you said, we have a choice about how, you know, what kind of sandwich we make. Eric just said he loves peanut butter and jelly.
Who doesn't love PB&J?
Gross. Sounds gross. But then I don't like peanut.
That's an English person speaking.
No. My sister used to spoon it out of the jar, peanut butter out of the jar with her fingers. She could not wait to get home from the grocery store. She'd open it in the car and spoon it with her fingers. I just don't like peanut butter, so that's why.
All right. You're the one.
There we go. I'm the one. But we can find out more about Tal Ben-Shahar, before I forget, at his website, which is, I'll spell it out for you. It's Tal, T-A-L, Ben, B-E-N, S-H-A-H-A-R.com. Tal Ben-Shahar. And his book, again, was Choose the Life You Want, 100 Ways to Create Your Own Road to Happiness. I like that book, Eric, and I'll tell you why. It's one of those books you can leave by the side of your desk, mm-hmm. and if you just need a little pick-me-up, it's some of them are a little page, you know, a short page, some are half a page, some are 1.5 pages, but you can just go through and pick it up at random and read whatever you want from it.
Get you motivated and back on track.
It does indeed. Well, we're going to take a quick break in just a moment. Before we do, I want to give you a heads up. Anybody who is working with anybody or has a family member, or maybe you have Parkinson's disease yourself, there is a webinar series for the entire Parkinson's community, and it's put on by the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation. It's called the Lunchtime Laboratory. They've already had the first one. We announced that last month. The second one is tomorrow, August 5th. And tomorrow, the topic is medications and side effects, finding your balance. And the speaker there is Lisa Mann, who has a list of letters after her name. She's from the Parkinson Center of Oregon at OHSU. And again, that's on tomorrow. You can find out more information if you go to the website nwpf.org, nwpf.org, and just look for Lunchtime Laboratory. And again, it's on medications and side effects tomorrow. All right, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be joined by Pacific Northwest Island writer and number one New York Times bestselling author Susan Wiggs. She'll be talking about her latest book, The Beekeeper's Ball. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, August 10th, it's Energetic and Harmonic Healing Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon in Seattle. They'll be in the studio where there are acutonics forks, Tibetan bowls, bells, rattles, and puas, eager to take your phone calls. So plan to call in for remote balancing, healing, or clearing sessions for you, your animal friends, your home, or business. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk. AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
News, traffic, and weather. Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth, because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel.
And welcome back, everybody. Yes, we're all about happiness today. And I'm very pleased to welcome back Susan Wiggs to the show. I know she's a listener favorite. She is a number one New York Times and USA Today bestselling author. She says the most important things in life are family, friends, and fiction. And that's going to come as no surprise to anyone reading her bestselling Lakeshore Chronicles. We are talking today about her newest release, The Beekeeper's Ball. And just let me give you a little bit more background on Susan. She had a novel, The Charm School, which was honored with the Dorothy Parker Award of Excellence. She was designated a favorite book of the year by Romance Writers of America. She's a proud recipient of 3 Rita Awards for Lakeside Cottage, Lord of the Night, and The Mistress. And her books regularly appear on numerous best of lists. So very pleased, Susan Wiggs, to welcome you back to the show today.
It's great to be back. Thank you very much. And by the way, I love the way you say the title of the book, The Beekeeper's Ball, in your special accent.
I was going to say, how did I say that?
Oh, great. It sounds very classy.
There we go. Well, tell us how you came up with that title, since we're talking about the title there.
Oh, it's a story. It's not a great one. It was actually at a meeting between my publisher and my literary agent and myself, and we knew it was going to be a follow-up to my book, The Apple Orchard, which turned into a reader favorite really quickly. And there were a few interesting elements in that book that just demanded that Isabel, the sister, she needs a story. And so for some reason, my agent decided that The Beekeeper's Ball would be like the perfect title. So this was the rare case where the title came before the story. But it kind of crystallized what I wanted to do. I wanted the yummy, beautiful Sonoma setting for the book, and I wanted it to be all about food and family history and, you know, how the past impacts the present. So for some reason, the Beekeeper's Ball just really resonated with me, and it was one of those titles that I didn't have to change because everybody really embraced it, and yeah. I think that readers are too.
Yeah. Interesting you should say that the title came before the story, because I read that when you were creating your characters, you're writing the book, you'd written quite a chunk of this book before you came up with a name for one of the main characters.
That's true. Naming characters is a bit like naming a baby. You've got to come up with something that sounds like this person. And the only thing I knew is I wanted some sort of Celtic flair. I love men's Celtic names, Ian and Sean and Flynn and all those. And so we went through quite a few. And then the other challenge when you're writing a series of books is to have each name sound unique so that readers don't confuse one name with the other.
Right.
You know, I can't have a Miriam and a Marion or something like that. So
After
all that, we finally came up with Cormac, and he goes by Mac, and he's very manly, very sexy. We just love him.
Yes, I think the name Mac conjures manly. Does to me, anyway.
Thank you. Yay. The plan is working.
So, Susan, for those who might be new to your work, the Beekeeper's Ball is the second in your Bella Vista Chronicles. In the first book, we heard a lot about Tess. And in this second book, I thought we're going to hear a lot more about Tess. But as you said, this is Isabel's story. So tell us a little bit about the story, if you would.
Yes. Yeah, so Tess and Isabel are sisters who don't meet until adulthood. They had a bit of a rogue for a father and didn't know about each other until they were adults and were brought together by their common paternal grandfather. And it turns out that they are thrown together on this amazing, beautiful family home called Bella Vista. That's where I got the name of the series, the Bella Vista Chronicles.
Where I'd like to move, by the way. If it were a real place.
Oh, I wish. You know, it's based on Sonoma, Sebastopol, Healdsburg, all those lovely little wine towns in wine country of California. And I've sort of drawn on elements from all of them. But it's a made-up place because when you're writing fiction, you need the town to have certain features. You want the farmer's market here and the library there. And so I ended up cobbling that together. But it feels very real to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope to readers as well. I hope they feel like they've been taken on a great ride when they go there.
Right, right. So let's talk a little bit about, you did intense research on this book. First of all, again, for those who aren't familiar with this series, you have two timelines in the book. You have historical and you have contemporary.
That's correct.
And you did more research for this book. Tell us a little, and the Danish resistance and stuff, but tell us a little bit about what went into that kind of research and why it was integral to this story.
I loved the setup that the elderly grandfather was a part of the Danish resistance in World War II, and he did some things, and things happened to him that ultimately brought him to Sonoma to become an apple grower and founded his family legacy there. However, there are a lot of secrets that are uncovered in the course of the book and several shocking developments, I guess, for both women to find out, but they affect Isabel the most. She's really the linchpin of this story, and she is a woman who has a lot of emotional fear in her life due to things that happened to her. And so my goal with Isabel was to try to bring the past into the present and show her how to be emotionally brave.
You also had to do a lot of research on bees. So
I did. I enjoyed that quite a lot, and it's very accessible. And it's also, as I found out through my research, it's quite of the moment because bees are in crisis. There's, you know, colony collapse syndrome and a number of of issues that are coming out. And so I became pretty passionate about it. And I'm not fond of bees, as you could probably tell from chapter one. I sort of have Isabel's feeling about it, but she was determined. And so she was determined to raise bees and keep bees in her beehives. And so that was just really the quick setup to show her fearfulness. And I definitely accessed my own when it came to that.
Right, right. Now, I thought this was really interesting because I'd never actually heard this term. And I actually studied film, so I must have been asleep in this class, I think. But you say that, you know, the beekeeping it's a metaphorical term, but it's sometimes referred to as a MacGuffin in fiction or film. Tell us about what that means.
It's a writer's term. I don't recall where I heard it. I think it comes probably from screenwriting, but the MacGuffin in a story is the thing that everybody wants or the goal. And so it has to be something tangible that you can read about and write about and create drama around. And so the MacGuffin was the beehives, but I can't write a really good novel about actually, you know, keeping bees. That's
right.
That's the hook that I hang the story on.
Right. And you've also provided some fantastic recipes, as you do in many of your books.
I love recipes. I love cooking. I love cookbooks. I love everything about it. And I get very excited about the local farm-to-table organic foods movement. And so the recipes included in the book were multiply tested by me. And I think I mentioned before the broadcast that I'm quite sure I packed on the pounds while I was writing this book, because every recipe that made it into the book, there were probably anywhere from, you know, 5 to 7 other ones that I had to test.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you some of my favorites. The bee sting cake.
Oh, boy.
A hummingbird cake, which is the wedding cake. We'll talk about the wedding
yeah,
in a minute.
That's so good.
And the Bella Vista cocktail. That sounded like something my mother would whip up.
that one I made up. It's so easy once you start, you know, kind of letting your imagination take hold and what flavors would go together. And, you know, I did a lot of reading and tasting about, you know, taste pairings. And honey is such an interesting ingredient because no two honeys are alike. They all have a distinct flavor. I think in cooking, sugar is sugar. It's just sweet. There's different types. But for the most part, honey is unique to where it's produced.
Right. And it's, you know, my grandmother taught me this, that honey is not supposed to be clear. We go to the grocery store and see all this clear honey, and we think it's not right if it's not clear. But the best, purest form of honey is very cloudy, isn't it?
Yes, I totally agree. The raw organic honey is remarkably healthy for us. And so, you know, and I hope that we see more and more of it in the shops. And I'm glad you brought up the grandmother, because that was a thread in the story as well. And in fact, I actually wrote an extra scene between Isabel and her grandmother cooking together. And that was included in a special edition of the book that comes from Barnes & Noble. They made a deal that I would write that extra scene so readers could get a glimpse. But I love the interplay between Isabel and her grandmother, who's passed on, but she has so many memories, and they're all tied up with food and cooking and the warmth of the kitchen. And so I think that, and I have that with my grandmothers as well, and it sounds like you do too, just
the little
nuggets of wisdom you get from her, they're really just something timeless that I think most readers can relate to, whether they have it in their life or not. I think everybody can relate to having that mentor figure.
Yes, it's invaluable. Absolutely. So I mentioned the wedding cake, the hummingbird cake. Tell us a little bit about the wedding, because Tess, who we met in the first book, her story does continue in the second, even though she plays a lesser part.
Right.
So tell us about the wedding.
Well, I love weddings. I love the idea of planning a wedding. I don't love actually doing it. there was a funny memoir that I actually wrote with my daughter back in 2010 that was published called How I Planned Your Wedding, and it was basically a memoir of the two of us fighting through the planning of my daughter's wedding, and it all ended up well. But I just love the idea of two sisters. I have, my best friend is my sister, working together on the wedding, and Isabel is this kind of homebody foodie type, and Tess is rather fabulous and chic. And so the two of them together planning Tess's perfect wedding right there at Bella Vista was a real fun ride for me to write about. And based on the feedback from readers, it's an enjoyable thread in that story.
Right. So this is the second in the Chronicle. There is going to be a third for sure. Do you see more down the road?
I do. If you read the book, you'll notice, and there are no spoilers in this conversation, but there are a couple of loose ends and some questions that are lingering. The book definitely has its own ending, but there are a couple of questions that linger in the mind and some issues that were brought up that go all the way back to the story of the Danish resistance during World War II. And so I can see myself bringing Tess and Isabel back again and again to sort through all that in subsequent books. They won't have, you know, their own story. It'll mm-hmm. be about different characters. And it's because I just fell in love with that setting, with Bella Vista. And so ultimately it's going to be quite the destination cooking school for future characters. And I can see people going to that cooking school to get away from things or reinvent their lives or something like that.
I can see people reading the book and looking it up on the internet to see if it's real.
wanting to sign up for this cooking school. Yes, I have had inquiries, and it's always fun to chat with readers. Most of them connect through Facebook on my Facebook page, and occasionally somebody will say, well, I looked on a map, and I was looking for it, and I can't really find it. And so I have to, you know, do full disclosure and say, well, yes, I made it up, but there are places like that that exist.
And now, I would think writing fiction, that's one of the best things, is creating this land. You know, as a nonfiction writer myself, I love learning new stuff. And of course, you get to do that when you're writing fiction, too. Is that one of your favorite things, too?
Oh, absolutely. I do love that. And I love being able to build a place in my mind that feels so real to me. And Bella Vista definitely is that. I mean, who wouldn't love to go to California wine country, stay in this amazing mansion mm-hmm. and with, you know, all the art and the artifacts and the past, and go out to the gardens and harvest things and then learn to cook them.
Right. So I have a writerly question for you. You're writing two different timelines here, historical, as we said, about the Danish resistance, and contemporary, what's going on right now. Do you write them simultaneously? Do you write the historical one first and then weave it in? How does that work for you?
Probably a little of both. I sort of know the arc of the story in the past, and then I try to pull the reader through the story by, you know, leaving something unsaid at the end of a chapter, and we turn the page and, oh, we're in Copenhagen and the Nazis are here. And so I try to use it not only for the, you know, to give the reader a good ride, but for myself as well, because as you know, being a writer, from a long piece like that mm-hmm. can get really, really challenging to mm-hmm. just day in and day out sit down and start again. And so one way that I trick myself into going on with the story is to keep it moving for myself as well. And in this one, it was challenging, but I would find an event in the past and then sort of find its parallel or its doppelganger in the present. And it was a fun challenge. It was not the easiest way to go with it, but I think ultimately it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, and the book is called The Beekeeper's Ball. Susan Wiggs, thank you so much for being with us today.
Vicki, I love this show. I love your readers. I go see you on Facebook. And so
and
thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And I wanted to let people know, Susan has a great Facebook page. It's very active. She's very active on there. So if you like to connect with your favorite authors, go check out Susan's Facebook page, and they can get to that from your website, right, Susan?
They can. And do not miss today's tomato recipe.
I'm
drowning in homegrown tomatoes here, and so I put up a great recipe. So don't miss that.
I will go check that out for sure.
Okay. Well, Vicki, thank you again. I really loved talking with you.
My pleasure. And the book again, The Beekeeper's Ball. And we will be back next week with an all live new show. I want to thank you for being with us today, and just quickly remind you that National Geographic. On the National Geographic channel tonight, you can hear my first guest from today. She's on the Brain Games show. It's all about food and why our brain does what it does around food. Anyway, we'll see you next week. If you have questions or comments on today's show, you can find me at info@conversationslive.net or at 800-495-7617. 800-495-7617. Until next week, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.